Well, it is a great pleasure here in Cardiff to catch up with Sally Nichols for my latest Nostalgia interview. Now, we've just been discussing, Sally, that we obviously have a Lampeter pedigree, but we are not sure when, if at all, we ever met, or at least spoke to each other before today.
Before today, yes. And I just feel, because we must have met, Chris. I'm sure our paths have crossed, and I'm sure we have a lot of mutual friends. But I feel this kind of connection with you simply because we are both Lampeter graduates. So I studied at Lampeter between 1992 and 1995, and I did a single honours degree in Welsh.
Yeah, now I was 91 to 94, I did theology, but we clearly had mutual friends, and of course we have the Lampeter Society in common, and as it turns out, we're both from this part of the world. So we're at the Red Dragon Centre, which I didn't even know existed until yesterday, and here in Cardiff Bay. And Cardiff Bay looks very different from when I was growing up in this part of the world. But you're from Lancashire area.
Originally, I am from Llantrisant, which is parish of the Three Saints. So that's where I started my life. And for the first 2 years, my parents lived in a cottage. I lived in a cottage, obviously, with them up in the old town, up in the old parish of Llantrisant. And then they moved, they bought a property on the outskirts of Llantrisant in quite a rural area. So I spent my childhood and my teenage years growing up in the countryside. So I was a bit of a tomboy growing up. So I have memories, fond memories of walking miles with my dog, walking up on the disused railway track, building dens, you know, climbing trees, and looking for sort of bullhead fish and under rocks in the river. So I did spend quite a lot of time on my own, actually, but it was great, and I had a fantastic childhood, and it was great growing up in the countryside. I really, really, really wanted a horse. I really wanted a pony, but my parents were dead set against that. So I just used to go and feed the horses. But it was. Yeah.
But did you ever fulfil that dream? So did you ever get a horse when you were a bit older?
No, I didn't, unfortunately, no. I went for riding lessons. I have been for riding lessons. But no, I haven't actually owned a horse. Although I did, when I was travelling a few years ago, I went to India. And I actually went horse riding in India, which was quite spectacular.
Yeah, but also it's the incongruity of it. Because going to a place a long way away, and I know you went to Patagonia as well, so we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But to go somewhere a long way away, but to do something that you could have done locally. I mean, an analogy, maybe not a very good one, is literally across from where I work, there's a cinema as part in one of the university buildings. It's literally like 10 feet away. But I go there maybe once a year. I'm always going. You know, I'm driving to Dover or to Ashford or to Rochester to see a film, because when it's on your doorstep, it's too easy. But
yeah.
But when you can do something that feels more exotic and special, because you're doing it in a location that's kind of more memorable or different, has that sort of sense of the other about it.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's also why Lampeter was somewhere that you went, because it's like familiar, because you enjoyed the country walks, but it was sufficiently far away for you to sort of have that sense of distance as well.
Well, I didn't know where I wanted to go to university. My dear Welsh teacher, the head Welsh at my secondary school, she was an Orthwalian lady, and she really, really wanted me to go to Bangor University. And I remember she actually organised a sixth form trip and took a group of us who were studying Welsh A-level. She took us up to North Wales. She took me to Bangor, and she was, "Sally, you have to come to this university." And I remember seeing the dining hall and seeing the Welsh hall then. I think it was John Morris Jones, hall. And it was fantastic. And I actually I applied for a scholarship. But I wasn't eligible for many of the scholarships because I wasn't from North Wales, I wasn't a resident there, I wasn't born there. So I didn't actually get the scholarship for Bangor. So then I kind of narrowed it down to, I think it was Aberystwyth and Lampeter. And I don't know why, but I just thought I'd end up in Aberystwyth. But I remember going to Lampeter for, it wasn't an open day then, I think I actually, I just went there for an interview. And I just fell in love with the place. and I fell in love with the old building, I just had this gut feeling that this, it was the right place for me to go, and then I actually won an entrance scholarship for Lampeter, so it all worked out fine in the end, you know?
And it's funny how those things happen, because when I went to a New Ents conference, that would have been in January 91, they had to put us up for actually two nights, because it was too far for most people to get to. You couldn't go there for the day in the way that you might do if you were going up to Manchester or to Cardiff. And so I remember going there, and suddenly for two nights, even though my sister was already there, so I had a family connection, suddenly it was like I was in this place, I was living like a student. And again, it was the exotic. We'd been on Scorsese's Taxi Driver, looking back, it's like, that was a bit risky, which ended up being one of my PhD sort of topics.
Yeah.
So, and I think it was all because of Lampeter. So in other words, that experience was so formative that it was like, I had to come back.
Yeah.
Almost like, that was the prelude. Those two nights were a taster, and there was no way I was going to miss the main event. But it's funny, because the number of people I've interviewed, Donna Timmis is another one I interviewed up in Durham in 2019, and she talked about the same thing, like going there, and you just sort of know, particularly when there's a long journey involved, that you come there and you think, actually, I may have travelled literally from one end of the country to the other, but you kind of just know that you're going to fit in there.
It's a little bit like when you sort of, when you're looking to buy a house, and you walk in, and you know within the first sort of 30 seconds, they say, whether or not you can, picture yourself living there, whether you think you're going to fit in. And I just had this, like I said, had this really positive vibe, this gut feeling that I thought, yeah, this is the place, this is where I want to be. And also, the attraction for me was being in a Welsh-speaking community in Ceredigion as well. So that was another another bonus, really. Yeah.
And so Welsh was always, was it Welsh? Welsh was the degree in Welsh studies?
My degree was in Welsh. Yeah. So I'm actually from a non-Welsh-speaking background. So my parents don't speak Welsh, and my brother, who's 8 years older than myself, our local primary school was an English medium school. And then in the early 70s, an organisation called Mudiad Meithrin, which I actually work for this organisation now, they established, we are like a charity, but basically they started up a lot of Welsh nurseries. So my father was friendly with the local head teacher, who was a Westphalian, who was Welsh speaking, and he kind of like persuaded my parents and encouraged my parents to send me to a Welsh nursery in the first instance. And he said, if she doesn't like it, it's not the end of the world, she could always, go to an English medium school. But I can't ever really remember not being able to speak Welsh. I think because you're basically immersed in the language in these Welsh nurseries, that's what happened. I loved the language. I was thriving in the language. I was coming home, singing things in Welsh, coming up with phrases. And my parents knew that they made the right decision there. And so I was lucky. I did. I went to a Welsh secondary school after the primary school. So I did all my GCSEs were completed through the medium of Welsh, apart from English. And then I went to Lampeter and did my degree then in Welsh. I was going to do joint honours because I love languages, and I did continue with German for a year. So initially I was contemplating doing a joint honours degree in Welsh and German, but then I just focused on Welsh.
Yeah, and I was just thinking as well that coming from a non-Welsh language home, maybe in some way that gave you more of an incentive to do Welsh, because it wasn't sort of an obvious thing to fit into. You had to try that much harder.
Yeah.
And I suppose in that sense, to stand out almost and sort of do something that wasn't almost like inevitable, you had that chance to run with that battle.
Yeah,
and you did. It just sounds as though that may have given you an extra incentive.
Yes, it did. And I've got to be honest as well, Chris, it's the Welsh literature. I have always, I enjoyed studying French literature, German literature, but it's definitely the Welsh literature. And, as part of my degree, studying work by Dafydd Ap Gwilym, we've gone back to like the 13th century, and also the earliest poets, Aneirin and Taliesin, and obviously their work goes back to the 5th and 6th century. And, I think I made the right decision.
And so Lampeter was 1992 to 95, And you have associations with Lampeter after all this time, I guess residual memories or residual sort of connections. There's somewhere that you go back, you're involved with the Lampeter Society. So just sort of unpack all of that. So you made that choice to go to Lampeter. And all these decades later, because I know people who often say they may not have had the most wonderful time there, but that you can never get out of your system. There's the old adage, isn't there? You can take the student out of Lampeter, but you can't take Lampeter out of the student. But so it sounds like lots of positive memories, but it sounds like it was kind of seminal in what you then went on to do subsequently in your life. Because you do a lot of work, of course, today in, you're doing a PhD, aren't you, around education
I've
and Welsh
full,
language.
Full circle, I'll be 50 next year, but yeah, I've come full circle. Yeah. It was something, I mean, some of the lecturers did sort of talk about maybe, you know, like the possibility of me continuing with research or perhaps doing a master's after I graduated, but I, by that point, I think I was determined. I really, really, really wanted to be a teacher. So I just thought, you know, I'm just going to go to Cardiff, do my PGCE, and then I spent, you know, the next sort of 20 plus years teaching Welsh. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's the journey. So in a funny way, it sounds as though, you know, I mean, people do different things at different times in different orders, but it sounds as though it's kind of all come full circle.
It has come full circle, and, you know, sometimes, you know, I think I went for a number of years perhaps regretting not doing research, you know, earlier or straight after I graduated. But I think I've got, you know, more than 20 years experience of teaching. I've been working in the field of Welsh language education, you know, since 1996. And I think that is definitely an added bonus when it comes to sort of doing my PhD and my research.
But of course you couldn't have done the PhD that you're doing now back in 1996 for reason. So actually that experience has actually been foundational. So it's actually that experience has led you to do the PhD, but building on the degree. So it's kind of, so it has sort of worked out in the right order.
It has. Everything's worked out okay in the end.
The number of times when I'm doing this podcast, people talk about fate and they talk about destiny and it was, you know, meant to be. But I think there's an element of truth in that. But often I think we steer it. But of course, there's always that inevitability that sometimes, I guess in my case, I always wanted to do something broadcasting radio-wise and I've kind of done it. Maybe at the age of 50. it may have taken me a few decades longer than I wanted to, but it kind of works out. So the Lampeter journey for me is an interesting one because it feels a bit kind of like circuitous. But I needed that Lampeter base, I think, in order to give me kind of, that was the experience that I wanted. That was the kickstart.
Yes.
And then it's almost like, I'm ready for whatever challenge. You know, 3 years in Lampeter, actually, there's a much bigger skill set in there than probably going to a city university. Yeah, I think that's very true. Okay, tell me a bit about growing up. So obviously, South Wales, one of the things that I always obsessively did was with friends at the playground. We talk about the music we grew up with, the charts. We're obviously the same generation. Was that something that was important for you growing up?
Well, I'm trying to think back to, my favourite childhood film was The Wizard of Oz. So I could repeat the script. I mean, literally word for word. I watched that film so many times. So growing up, I enjoyed that particular film. The work of, you know, C.S. Lewis again. You know, Narnia. I think it was that the feeling of escapism and being able to, you know, go to a different land, go to a different place. So, yeah, so, you know, I had quite a vivid imagination as a child because, like I said, you know, I spent quite a lot of time on my own in the countryside, you know, walking and, I'd be walking through these woods thinking I was walking through some, you know, Enid Blyton enchanted wood or something, you know. But, and then obviously in the 80s, yeah, I loved, you know, the classic 80s music, 90s. I was a big Jason Donovan fan. And I'll admit to that now, big Jason Donovan fan in the 90s. But I grew up with, my mother was, and still is to this day, a massive Neil Diamond fan. So I grew up with the soundtrack of Neil Diamond to my childhood, really, and that kind of evolved to being the soundtrack to my life. So, I've been fortunate enough. I've crossed the pond a couple of times to see Neil. And I've seen him when he's played in Birmingham, and he did actually, in 2008, he did actually come to the Principality Stadium, and he played in Cardiff. So, yeah, I've always been a massive Neil Diamond fan.
See, I was about to show off and say in 2011 I saw him at the O2, but then you said you crossed the pond to see him, and I realised that actually you really have followed that through. So you saw him in America?
So I've seen him, yeah, I saw him. I've seen him in Las Vegas. I'm going back a number of years now. I've seen him in Las Vegas. I've seen him in Nashville. And I've also seen him in New York, in Madison Square Gardens. And actually, I was probably at one of the same concerts as you then in the O2 in London. Yeah. And believe it or not, I actually had a ticket because I was due to go out to visit family in Australia. I had a ticket to see him play in the Rod Laver Stadium in Melbourne in 2018. But of course, he had the diagnosis of Parkinson's. And so even though I was in possession of that ticket, that never actually materialised. And I remember being in Melbourne on the day that the concert should have taken place, and sort of driving past and being quite emotional. I followed Neil around the world.
You see, there's something about the soundtrack to a life, because I have a similar sort of thing, you know, radio presenters, often those who are still going, you know, like Tony Blackburn, well into their 80s. I grew up listening to them, and they're still going, and in a way they're as good as ever, that, you know, they are. But for someone like Neil Diamond as well, cross generations, it was your mother who effectively brought you. But your interest superseded hers, I'm guessing, or does she accompany you?
So we've been, I think the first time I ever saw Neil Diamond, actually, I was in Las Vegas on my own. So, no, yeah, it was one of those things that, you know, I've got to come see him. I mean, you know, his soundtrack has been the soundtrack of my childhood, and it kind of, like, I took it from there, you know. Another artist who was sort of really important to me during my sort of teenage years as well was Sting. And one of my favourite albums is The Soul Cages. So, yeah, I think music is important, isn't it? Because it's you know, sometimes it's the lyrics, you know, that are important. It's a soundtrack to your life sometimes.
And you saw Sting, was it at one of the castles just a few months ago? Am I right?
Yes, I've seen Sting a few times.
I remember now, you posted.
But I saw him playing Cardiff Castle.
Cardiff Castle.
Yeah, it was just literally Sting and his guitar, like an acoustic set, you know. But he was fantastic, he was brilliant. Yeah. And I have a lot of respect for singer-songwriters, you know, not just performers, but people who actually write their own material, perform their own material, because, you know, they sing it from the heart, you know.
That's amazing, because I always find that when you go and see an artist in concert, as if you're used to it, you know what you're expecting, it's okay. But when I saw Neil Diamond, it was so excited to see him. But the O2 is a very big arena, and I didn't have a very good seat. And there was a big screen, a giant screen, next to where we were. We spent the whole evening watching him on the big screen, and he was just a dot in the distance.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, I've come all this way, I'm that close to seeing him, but he's just a dot in the distance, and I'm watching him on this screen. I could have been doing this at home. And so there was something about that something didn't connect.
Yeah.
But I have been to the O2 on other occasions. It's a wonderful sort of venue. But is there something about seeing an artist live, like Neil Diamond? We may have been there on the same evening. So maybe you got a better seat than I did.
It's amazing with, you know, with the screens and everything, that you can actually see the artist's facial expressions, because I think that's really important, you know, when they are performing, when they are singing, that you have that connection. But I think it's just the fact, Chris, that you're actually in the same building as your idol at the same time, enjoying their music. I think that's, you know.
But just thinking, so when you see someone like Neil Diamond, is there a part of you that would contact Neil Diamond? Would you sort of write? Have you ever sort of written in and said, "Oh, you know, I'm a great fan. Do you have his autograph?" Or is there a sense of distance, like you follow him, but it's very sort of, you know, hands off? The idea that you approach, because people do, they're sort of like, you know, obviously try and contact their idols, and I always find that I've met people who work in the world of film, filmmakers, and I've met them, spoken to them. And I've sometimes been really quite underwhelmed, because, you know, I'm more interested in their work than sometimes perhaps they seem to be themselves. And suddenly you think, gosh, you know, maybe you need that distance. You need to watch their stuff, but maybe not with them in the room, kind of thing. What was your sense of seeing Neil Diamond?
There's that kind of, like, distance with somebody like Neil Diamond. I will admit to writing to one celebrity, though. And that is another idol of mine, Michael Palin. So, because as you probably have gathered, I enjoy travelling, quite obsessed with travelling. I'm a proper drama maniac, you know. And
he strikes me as very approachable.
He is approachable. I've met him on several occasions, and he is extremely approachable. Actually, he's probably the only man who has ever left me lost for words, because I've been so much in awe of him. I think the first time I met him, he was chatting away to me, and I was just sort of couldn't think of anything to say to him and couldn't get my words out, you know. But no, he's lovely. And it all started back in 1988, it must have been about 1988 when he did his first series, Around the World in 80 Days.
Yes, he's doing the Phileas Fogg journey, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I think I started watching that. That was his first series that he recorded with the BBC. And obviously then he went on to you know, make several series with the BBC. And then obviously in more recent years he's done some work with Channel 5. But he's inspired me to travel, and I didn't, as a child, we didn't really have sort of my family life, you know, my family was slightly dysfunctional, and I didn't have sort of many family holidays. But as a teenager, I started going on different holidays with the school. So I went on a few skiing trips, a few exchanges to Brittany, and I kind of got the travel bug then. I was bitten by the travel bug. And the minute I graduated from Lampeter and I started teaching and I started earning, you know, because let's be honest, you know, your starting salary as a teacher is quite good, you know. So for a 22-year-old, I was, you know, earning quite a healthy salary at the time. That was it then. I didn't have any responsibilities. I worked hard during term time, and then I made the most of the holidays, and I started travelling.
Yeah, because I remember reading the diaries, or the most recently published one, and that covered the period from 88, you know, well into the 90s. And it was phenomenal because, I've kept a diary. I have a diary from my Lamberton years. Not quite in the Michael Palin league. I mean, I probably write about 2,000 words a day now.
Yeah.
But he was such an inspiration.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you know, he's very good at dealing with the everyday, the prosaic stuff. As well, of course, everyone wants to know when he has a, you know, meeting the other pythons. Then, of course, that's obviously what everybody wants to read.
Yeah.
But did you kind of see the journeys that he made? And was that the sort of the inspiration? I know you went to Patagonia, for example, but was that kind of, so the travel bug, was it sort of largely down to the way that he recounted his journeys and the way he made it seem almost like so exotic, so exciting, something that actually you could do?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, some of the journeys that I've done when I was, you know, in my sort of mid to late 20s and in my 30s, they were definitely inspired by Michael Palin. I did a fantastic trip to Nepal, and that was inspired by his Himalaya series. So I did a trek in Nepal, and I went whitewater rafting down the River Seti. So that was down to that particular series. Another trek I did in Morocco in the Atlas Mountains and the Anti-Atlas Mountains. Again, that was inspired by his series Sahara. So yes, it was. You know, he would kind of, not that he would necessarily go off the beaten track, but he would, you know, he would open the door and show you, give you, you know, you'd have a glimpse of somewhere perhaps you wouldn't necessarily have thought of travelling to. So I remember him doing the New Europe series and going to Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia. So like a year or so later, I did the same, do you know what I mean? So yeah, he definitely inspired my choice of travel destinations.
And when you said that he left you without words, so when and how did you meet him?
Oh gosh, I should have actually, I had booked, I should have been out in Turkey, but I, on a holiday during a half term, but I knew that he was coming to Waterstones in Cardiff to do a book signing. So, believe it or not, I actually didn't get on the original flight that I booked. I booked a flight the following day, and then I queued up with everyone else just for him to sign a book that I already had.
Yeah.
But I bought another copy, obviously. Yeah. But just to meet him, I think, that was the first time. Yeah. And then I actually handed him a letter. I'd written him a letter, and I remember him putting the letter inside his jacket and saying, "Oh, thank you, I'll read that." And then I didn't hear from him for months on end, months and months and months, and I was like, oh, you know, very disappointed. But then, obviously, he'd gone out on tour promoting his book. I think after Cardiff, he'd kind of like flown to Australia and New Zealand. So I did hear from him, but I had to wait for sort of 3 months. But it was because he had been overseas promoting his work. And a lovely letter back, you know.
Yeah, and that makes such a difference because, you know, you often see a film program that I present. We were talking about a film called Galaxy Quest, which is about the Star Trek, really. It's like a spoof of that. And then how the actors really are just, you know, that's their job. They don't really care about what they're making. They think it's rubbish. They don't care about the fans. The fans are obsessed with their work, but they're contractually bound to turn up at all the conventions and do that. And like, you know, all these screaming fans, and they're like, you know, well, we don't, you know, care about this. But when you get a letter like that from Michael Palin, and that must have meant so much because it showed that actually your investment had kind of paid off. It was worth it. It was realistic. It had, you know, in a way, they did this perfect alignment.
Yes, definitely. And I also had a signed photograph, which is now in a gold frame in my study.
Yeah.
He'd obviously signed it with a marker pen, and to Sally, keep travelling, you know. And I've since met him, you know, on a few other occasions doing book signings, and been charming.
Did he remember you?
I don't think so.
But when he said you were lost for words, it was sort of like when he said, "Sally, we meet again."
I think
that's incredible. Tell me about Patagonia.
Patagonia, okay. Ever since I sort of graduated, I've always had a bucket list of things that I've wanted to do. Not necessarily places I've wanted to go, but things I've wanted to achieve. So obviously, doing my postgraduate teaching qualification was one, and I wanted to teach, so I fulfilled that. And PhD now, I'm actually starting to tick that box. You know, I'm in my second year of doing my PhD, but that was always on my list of things that I wanted to do. But so was teaching Welsh in Patagonia. And it's something that had been on the back burner for a number of years. And you know, I taught Welsh in secondary schools for over 20 years. I was a head of department in three different schools in South Wales. And I always had this urge to go to Patagonia and teach Welsh. And every year, the British Council, they actually advertise the post. And every year I'd look at it and think, oh gosh, I really want to do this, but now is not the right time. There'd always be some reason preventing me from going. And I sat down with my mother this one particular day, and she said, "Look, Sally, if you want to go to Patagonia and it's something that you really, really want to do with your life, you need to go for it. You need to apply for the post and just see what happens." So I applied for the post. I didn't think in a million years that I would get it, but it was just one of those things. You know, if you don't try, you just don't know. And I was successful. And I think I applied in, I think my interview was in the December. And then in the February, I was flying out to Patagonia. But at the time, I was, you know, well, I'm still out working for Midyard Meithrin. So basically, they let me go out there as a bit of a like sabbatical year, you know. But I couldn't have picked a worse year to go out because, of course, it was COVID.
No, so you went. So it was quite recent years that you went.
So I went out flew out in 2020, and I remember being in Terminal 5, being in the airport, thinking, you know, oh my gosh, I mustn't touch anything. You know, I could see all these like flights from all around the world, and people were starting to talk. You know, there were cases of COVID.
So was this sort of like February, March period?
This was the February half term, so this was mid-February 2020.
Yeah.
And I remember being, you know, super careful, you know, in Heathrow, telling my daughter, you know, to make sure she was washing her hands thoroughly and everything. Anyway, flew out to Buenos Aires and then to actually fly onto Patagonia. It's another like 2.5 hour flight then from Buenos Aires down to Esquel, where I was based. So I was actually based in the Andes. So I was, you know, virtually on the border with Chile. It was great. My daughter went to Ysgol y Cwm, which is a bilingual Welsh and Spanish school. It was a picture postcard driving to work every day. I can't begin to describe what it was like just living in Esquel, living in one town, and then obviously driving to Trevelin, where I worked in the school. So I worked in the school, and I also taught in a language centre in Esquel, where we had the house. So it was amazing. I made lots of friends. Obviously they're going to be friends for life now. The community spirit, the fact that these people are so proud of their heritage, and a lot of them are descendants from the original Mimosa boat that left Liverpool in 1865, I think is the year, left Liverpool with about 160 people on board. Took 2 months to sail from Liverpool to Portmadryn. So a lot of friends of mine, they are actually descendants of the original people who actually went out to South America to start a new life, to be able to use the Welsh language and to live freely as Welsh people,
Yeah, and were you able to make the most of the time there? Because when you said COVID hit, I don't know if it hit in the same way as it did in the UK, and you would have been aware of what was happening back home. But did it impact on what you were able to achieve?
Unfortunately,
there?
It did. So by March, by sort of mid-March, we'd gone into a really strict lockdown in Argentina. And I was obviously still in contact with friends back home, and a lot of my friends are in the teaching profession. And the schools were still open. They were still going to school. They were still teaching. And I couldn't believe it, because we couldn't even leave the house, So I very, very, very quickly, my teaching face-to-face turned into teaching over Zoom. Yeah. And virtually overnight, I had to acquire all these different skills of teaching and sharing my PowerPoint slides and, planning lessons over Zoom. And the challenging thing for me was the fact that a lot of my students couldn't speak English. Yeah. So I couldn't speak Spanish, even though obviously the plan was for me to go out there and to learn Spanish, and I learned quite a bit in the short space of time between being successful at the interview and actually flying out there. I had kind of like started to learn some phrases, but I was having all of a sudden I was having to teach not only over Zoom, but obviously not being having to just immerse my students in the Welsh and just using target language, because I didn't have any Spanish. And it is difficult teaching when you're not doing it face to face.
Yeah, and you're right. And also, I had the same issue, but I at least wasn't in another country where there was a language barrier.
Yeah.
So it sounded as though you had multiple obstacles. How long were you there for? Was it 3 months or longer?
Or
indeed longer, because you probably couldn't leave.
Right. So, Argentina was very, very strict. The president was very strict, and we went straight into a lockdown. All the internal flights and all the international flights were grounded straight away, which was completely different to what was happening here in the UK. And so I just planned on sort of staying there, and I was stuck really.
Yeah.
So I planned on staying there and just teaching. And at that point, I think everyone thought, oh, everything's going to open back up in a month or two. It's all going to be okay. It's all going to be fine. But it was obviously going from kind of like bad to worse, And in the end, I had no choice but to come back, simply because the British Embassy, put on a repatriation flight. And had I not accepted that, my husband and daughter wouldn't have had adequate medical insurance. I was fine. My insurance was fine with the British Council, so we didn't have a choice. So I flew back the end of May.
Yeah.
And that was a surreal experience. That was, everything was on lockdown in Argentina. So we had to travel by coach, by bus, about 34, 35 hours from where we lived in Esquel in the Andes up to Buenos Aires. couldn't really stop. And I mean, they were so strict in Argentina. I mean, our coach was checked every couple of miles. Yeah. You know, people were coming on, you know, police coming on, checking things. We had one toilet on this bus, and you can just imagine what it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
We couldn't stop at service stations and things. It was just horrendous.
Yeah.
And got to Buenos Aires, and I have never, ever, you know, I'm quite well travelled, but I've never, ever been in a situation. It was like something off Armageddon. It was something like off a film. Literally, you know, the airport, everything in the airport was closed. We had people in kind of like, they looked like marshmallow men, you know, the big white costumes, you know, taking our temperature. It was horrendous. It was awful.
Yeah, and also there's no precedent for that outside of movies in that sense, because suddenly the way in which our liberties were curtailed. But I mean, I was lucky because I was, you know, I was with my children, etc. Okay, so you were with your family, but presumably your daughter, who would have started out going to a physical school, which was bilingual, but then she presumably was taught over Zoom or equivalent during that period. So you were in one room effectively doing your teaching, and she was being taught in another using the same technology. But when you wouldn't have been, you know, you wouldn't have had the necessary equipment or the expectation of how that could be done. It must have been impossible to get all the logistics right.
It was really, really difficult. And I mean, she, you know, obviously, she was doing online lessons. She was still trying to progress with her Spanish. And, you know, my daughter is a bit of a linguist and enjoys languages. And she was, you know, trying to improve with her Spanish. But it was difficult. It was really difficult. And actually, a sister of one of the teachers in her school back in Wales actually got in touch with me and said, look, you know, if she needs anything, then obviously, or wants to join some of our lessons, because we were stranded, you know, we were stuck.
Yeah.
But it continued, and then I flew back in the May, and like I said, it was such a surreal experience. It was like something out of a horror movie. It was awful, absolutely awful. Landed in Gatwick, and oh my gosh, the difference, and how, I don't know, how sort of blasé people were about it. We'd been in a country where everything had been so strict, you know, and everybody abided by the rules, and all of a sudden we landed in Gatwick, and yes, it was, you know, the airport was virtually like derelict, but yeah, they were, you know, I travelling from London back to South Wales on the M4, I could see, you know, camper vans, you know, caravans. I'm like, oh my gosh, is this for real? Is this really happening? Because, like I said, we had been on such a strict lockdown in Argentina.
Yeah. No, I mean, my recollection during that period is that although we were in lockdown, that there was still that bizarre sense that you were allowed to go out for walks and you go down to your local park, and inevitably you'd bump into people who, parents with their children, and you'd say, oh, hi, you know, you keep a distance, but you weren't allowed to meet members of your family. You weren't allowed to have, you know, group meetings. But if you were randomly going to meet somebody in a, you know, you bumped into something in the park, well, there's nothing to stop you talking. And it just felt like, you know, we were in lockdown, there are things we're not allowed to do, but go to the supermarket. You could go to the supermarket as often as you liked, and you'd have to keep your distance, but often you'd see people in the supermarket, like, hi, how are you managing, and so on. And it felt a bit weird, like you were still able to do some of the things that you could do, but in a more controlled space. But it kind of felt like it wasn't complete lockdown. It felt like a bit half and half.
Yeah, and this is how bizarre it was. Yeah. And obviously, back in the UK, you were allowed to go out and exercise. We couldn't do that in Argentina. So I was literally running 5Ks in my small garden, you know, running round and round and round and round. And to go shopping, it all depend, you know, you weren't eligible, you know, you couldn't go shopping every day. You didn't have that kind of freedom. If you were Argentinian, it depended on your national identity card. So if your card ended in an odd number, you could go on like Monday, Wednesday, Friday kind of thing. Obviously, we have to go according to our passport numbers. So yes, that's how strict they were. You'd have the police with kind of like loudspeakers and sirens driving up and down the streets. And to be honest, where I was living, you know, in the Andes, I was in the back of beyond. Do you know what I mean? There wasn't a single case of COVID.
Yeah.
And actually, I flew back, and the first case of COVID wasn't until sort of like 6 months after I'd returned. You know.
Would you go back, or did that after going there? I mean, obviously, if you did go back, the chances of a repeat of anything like that is very, very slim. But do you kind of feel that you had your chance and now you've got to move on?
I will go back, simply because I feel I didn't fulfil everything that I wanted to do, that I set out to achieve, and I have unfinished business, so to speak. Do you know what I mean? And it's something I'm passionate about, something I've always wanted to do. Obviously now is not the right time, you know, because my daughter is, you know, in the middle of sort of doing her GCSEs. But it's something I will obviously think about, you know, doing in the future, definitely. Yeah.
And I've got to ask you, and one of the questions I always ask in this podcast is about, you know, whether you can be nostalgic about, you know, negative experiences. And just in the light of what you've been talking about, I mean, it sounds as though it was a weird experience, but probably one that, I don't know if you like kept a diary during that period, or whether you've got lots of photographs, or whether you lots of posts, you know, social media or whatever. But is there a sense in which you either do or do not want to have a record of that? Is it something that you want to remember? Do you kind of look at it and think, actually, there was a lot that you learned about yourself, like how resilient you could be, because you were physically, you know, lockdown was difficult for people who were just, you know, often in their usual physical spaces, but they couldn't talk to the neighbour across the road. But in your case, you were literally the other side of the world. But you sort of look back, is there anything that you could say that you were nostalgic about relating to that period?
It was, yeah, you know, I could say it was obviously, you know, there were a lot of negative aspects. A lot of positive things came out of it as well. And I think one of the most positive things was how my friends that I'd made, who I'd only known for a short length of time, how they rallied around and they did absolutely everything possible to help us as a family. Yeah. I mean, the paperwork to actually fly home was a nightmare, you know, the repatriation flight. And a good friend of mine, she was a lawyer. So she helped, because I mean, everything was in Spanish as well, all the paperwork was in Spanish. And you know, my friends couldn't do enough. We literally had to like jump on a plane last minute, so another friend sort of, you know, we had to leave our car out there, so another friend looked after our car, took our luggage, you know. I think it's how everybody kind of like rallied around. And I've got to be honest, the Patagonians, the Argentinians are are just lovely, lovely, lovely people. They will do anything for anyone.
And did you keep in touch with any of them?
Yes, we're in touch. You know, obviously social media makes it, you know, easy to keep in touch with these people. But even before I actually flew out there, I was getting like random like WhatsApp messages from people asking me things. So they wanted to, you know, they were really, really friendly from the word go. The minute they knew that I was going out there as a Welsh language development officer and as a teacher, they were lovely, lovely, lovely people, you know, couldn't do enough, you know, met me at the airport, you know, and accepted me straight away as part of their community.
So I often think, if there'd been the COVID pandemic when we were at Lampeter, what would have happened? Somebody said to me that maybe in those days, we weren't quite on the internet in that era, so maybe there would have been some form of radio-based learning, but you know, because obviously we look back with a certain amount of fondness and affection for Lampeter in a way that my own children, I think, would find the whole idea that we'd have to queue up outside a phone box to get those cheap calls at 6 o'clock in the evening, and we didn't have Netflix, we didn't have YouTube. And I had a black and white TV, but
so
I had to hold the aerial
in order
to get good reception. And I think they'd find that very strange. But, you know, if we'd had a pandemic on top of that, I wonder, we would have coped somehow, but I wonder what would have been different?
What would have been different? Oh, I'm not sure. Because, like yourself, I mean, when we were at Lampeter, we were, like, kind of, like, cut off from the world.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
I remember going down to the union, student union, and, you know, I'd have friends of mine who would write to me. My mother would write, you know, literally would write letters. I mean, we are talking about, you know, you didn't have text messages, you didn't have mobile phones, you didn't have the internet. And, you know, the kind of like feeling, you know, walking down to the Students' Union, you know, seeing an envelope in my pigeonhole and being really, really excited. What would we have been like? I don't know. When I think about my first year in Lampeter, I was in the Welsh Hall, the Simon Evans Hall. And oh my gosh, did we have fun there?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I think had we all been on lockdown together there, we would have had lots of fun. We probably would have had to, you know, refrain from killing each other. But when I think about the practical jokes we used to play on each other and how we'd all muck in, I'm sure we would have been.
And I just think it's because you just hit the nail on the head about like letter writing, because in those days, you know, getting a letter or sending a letter. I mean, these days, WhatsApp, and you can send it to multiple people.
Yeah.
You can, you know, there's no worry about losing your photographs, because in those days, I lost Lampeter to photographs. I'd go to Boots and find that I hadn't, you know, wound the film on properly. Not too many, but there are one or two, though. There's like a missing term there, somewhere, missing semester somewhere. But letter writing was something that I used to do, mainly to family members, but often even in vacation. You know, I'd write letters to, you know, to friends.
Postcards.
Yeah, even though I'd be seeing them just 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
But there's something about that, because we don't do anything like that anymore. Even like, I mean, there's a funny story, because I went to see my parents in Ross-on-Wye just last week, just before Christmas. We're recording this in that week between Christmas and New Year. And I had all my cards, and I had a few last-minute cards to send. And I thought, oh, I'll just stop off at the service station and post them. And they looked at me like I was from the moon, because they were like, you know, we don't sell stamps anywhere, you know, in this service station. There's a post box out there. They sell cards, but you can't post them. And I just thought that is what has changed.
Yeah.
You know, 30 years ago, it was unthinkable that you wouldn't be able to.
Yeah.
And you'd often buy individual stamps rather than book of stamps, because, you know, you just wanted to send that, you know, 13p and you send it, whatever, second class. But that feels like a big change. So do you feel there's anything from your Lampeter days that feels particularly strange, except maybe from your daughter's perspective?
Well, do you know what's really bizarre is the fact that when I think back to my days as an undergraduate, I actually, all my essays that I submitted were actually handwritten, Chris. They were all handwritten.
Yeah.
So it was like, if I needed to, you know, do another draft or another version, it wasn't a case of just deleting things, copy and paste, you know, cut this, cut that, you know, running things through spell check or Skyro. That didn't exist. I think things started to change by the time I started doing my teaching degree, you know, my postgraduate degree. I think I had like a word processor in 1996, you know, but as an undergraduate, everything was handwritten. And I see my daughter today, trying to explain to her, oh my gosh, you know, that we didn't have social media, we didn't have WhatsApp, we couldn't send text messages. You know, I had a queue to wait to use a phone and actually put money
coins
in the actual phone. It's like as if I'm from a different planet, really.
Yeah. I think that's it, because when you see a young child doing PowerPoint presentations, and you see, or my daughter, you know, one of my daughters will be doing like a PowerPoint presentation for school. I've got colleagues at work who are not particularly adept at using PowerPoint. And that is like the sea change, because they grew up with that. They've grown up with multiple channels.
Yes.
They've grown up with sort of TV on demand.
Yeah.
But there was something about that method of writing essays when you literally had to put pen to paper, which I suppose kind of made that it was like a concretization of something. But you wouldn't do it anymore. I can't think of very many occasions, professionally anyway, where I would actually write something down. Even my students do their exams now as they're like timed exams, they do them over Moodle or some other, you know, teaching resource. So that feels different from the Lampeter days.
Definitely, yeah. And when I think back, I just can't believe I did it. I can't believe I did it that way, you know?
But isn't that thing about retrospect? Because we know now that those things sound almost like fun. And that's another reason why I often love going back to Lampeter, because it's proof that I existed there. And I did those things, and you know, and I forgot to look. Maybe you know the answer to this, but I posted something from Lloyd Thomas. Someone said, "Are the phone boxes still there?" And I forgot to. I said, "Or maybe one of them is there. Or maybe they've both been taken away now." But of course, I used to look. I lived in Burgess Hall. I'd been looking down those two phone boxes on the corner, and that was my route to the outside world. These days, we would just do it on our tablets, on our phones.
Yeah.
But back then, you'd literally, as you say, have to put a physical 50p or whatever pence piece into the machine.
But you'd have to factor those things into your day as well, wouldn't you? Yeah. It's a part of my daily routine, is sort of going to the Students' Union to check my mail, or, you know, going to make a phone call. It wasn't, you know, literally, when you think of how people live in this day and age and everything is, you know, the technology and the speed of things, and we didn't have all that. There's something quite nice about that, Chris.
Yeah.
There was something, you know.
Yeah. It feels, in some ways, uncluttered. We didn't see it that way at the time. Because one advantage I find with keeping a diary is that it's a corrective against that grass is always greener on the other side, or, you know, sort of lens. Because sometimes I might think, oh, those were happy days, and then you look and you think, yeah, but we think they're happy because if you got a good degree result, or things worked out okay in the end, then you can look back and say, yeah, they was all good. But of course, at the time, it's full of anxiety. Like, I've got this essay to do, I'm worried about whether I'm on top, whether I'm going to manage, and you're worried about your accommodation, your friends, you know, the future, what you're going to do when you leave, or in my case, it was the States, and that's another, you know, you toured the world, and I kind of stayed put in that small, you know, town. My own sort of version of lockdown, with like a weekly release to Swansea or Cardiff, you know, to see the cinema, which became a professional sort of, you know, interest as well. But there is something about retrospect, I think, that, you know, it's important that we have those memories, because it shows, and lockdown perhaps accentuated that, what you have to do when your resources are limited, without necessarily knowing how limited at the time, because, you know, in 30 years' time, we'll probably look back and think, how did we manage in 2023?
I remember as well, Chris, in my second year, I lived in a flat above a decorating centre, and everything was on the meter for the electricity. Yeah. And I remember having to go to the local... most of the banks are closed now, aren't they? Yeah. All our high street banks where I live are closed. But I remember having to go to the Western Lampeton queue up and actually ask for 50 pence pieces, because they were the only pieces that I could actually insert into the meter. And like I said, everything, you know, in this day and age, everything's so easy, isn't it? But that was... Do you know what I mean? That was part of my, you know, growing up, part of my, you know, university days. And I can look back with and laugh about it. I remember being, you know, absolutely frozen and seeing ice on the windows because I'd run out of, you know, my 50 pence pieces. Yeah. But I can laugh about it now. But at the time,
because you just reminded me of something, because I went to Kent in 2004. And I think for the first 6, 7, 8 years, maybe even longer, if ever I went to the dining hall for lunch, they only accepted cash. So I would often be dashing over to the NatWest on campus, which, you know, which isn't there now, to the cash machine to get a £10 note or whatever it was, and then going over to the dining hall and hope, you know, I got there before they closed. These days it's all contactless. I think lockdown is what changed that. So just a few years ago, a card was useless. It only accept cash. Now, I can't remember the last time I actually used cash for a transaction.
No. And my daughter, my 15-year-old, well, she'll be 15 now in March. I mean, she's sort of like the queen, you know. She used to be, you know, she's like, cash? I don't do cash. Yeah. Mom, I don't do cash. Yeah. Can you, like, top up my, you know, everything is sort of presenting her mobile phone to pay for things. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I don't do cash, Mom. You know, it's, what is that? That is horrendous. I'm not touching that, you know. Yeah. But that's the day, you know, that's the era we live in, isn't it? Things have changed. Things have moved along, you know.
Yeah. Well, just a couple of questions as you start to round off, Sally. Would your younger self, say when you were, you know, when you were your daughter's age, would you have been surprised at the route that you followed in life, personally and professionally?
Would I be surprised? I think my younger self would be extremely proud of what I've done in my professional life and what I've achieved and what I set out to achieve and what I've managed to accomplish. I look back and think it's probably not the, like I said earlier, it's not the route I would have necessarily taken, and, you know, it's taken me till I'm going to be sort of in my early 50s by the time I you know, hopefully get my PhD. But yeah, I mean, my, you know, my personal life, you know, has been a bit of a roller coaster, you know, a bit colourful, perhaps not, you know, not taken the course that I would have liked, but then that's life, isn't it? I mean, you know, you learn from your mistakes, you know, there are lessons to be learned. You know, I don't look back and regret anything. I don't look back and regret anything, really, because I think hopefully things have, you know, different things that have happened in life have made me perhaps a better person.
Yeah. And you're in touch with those many friends from your, you mentioned the Patagonia people you're in touch with, but not least through social media, I guess, through school friends and certainly Lampeter friends.
Yeah, with Lampeter, there's a close knit group of us who were in the Welsh Hall in Simon Evans. We kept in touch a lot by letters and things, you know, after we graduated. And of course, I don't know if you remember, but before Facebook was established, there was I think this, I'm going back to sort of the mid-90s to the noughties, there was Friends Reunited.
Yes,
do you remember Friends
Reunited?
I do remember that. So actually, I got in touch with a number of people that I had lost touch with in Lampeter, or from Lampeter, through Friends Reunited. And then, of course, that, you know, Friends Reunited, you know, went by the by. And then, of course, it was Facebook. And it's amazing now, because you can keep in touch with anyone, you know, anywhere in the world, really, can't you? And you can go for months, you can go for years, actually, without seeing them face to face. Yeah. But you know exactly what they're up to and what they're doing. If they post regularly, you know, it's, you're kind of like in touch with them, you know, which is great.
Yeah, and it's worth saying as well, because this is the first time to our knowledge we've spoken, and yet we immediately recognised each other. Well, obviously we'd arranged to meet in a certain place, but of course we know exactly what we're all up to through our social media posts. So it's in a way that back in our Lampeter days, although we always bumped into, it was an artificial environment, because, and I've even found this happen at reunions, you bump into the same people seven times a day. There are often people that you don't meet, like we didn't really know each other back then, but often you always see the same people all the time. So we managed without texting in those days, because we always knew we'd physically see someone. Yeah. Although I think I did start to use email in my second year, although I had to go to the physical computer room in order to read my email and send emails. So often it would be, are you going down the bar tonight? So if you want to know the answer to that question, you have to go to the middle room, which was halfway over towards the bar, to see the answer. And then hopefully you were hoping that they might say yes at 9 o'clock. And you say, oh, right, you know, well, I'll just stay here and check my emails and then see you in the bar. So strangely kind of, or they probably have to go in themselves in order to read the email. So it was a slightly artificial, like clunky version of what we do now. But my very last question for you, Sally, is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, that's a difficult question. Because I think you have to live in the present moment. I'm not a particularly religious person. I'm quite a spiritual person, and you know, there are aspects of Buddhism that I, you know, that I look into, and you know, I quite enjoy. So I'm all about living in the present moment. I do like looking back, though. I like looking back and feeling nostalgic and having, you know, fond memories of my childhood, of my time growing up. But I'm also very, very excited about the future as well. You know, nobody knows what's around the corner. We don't know what the future holds. I think we have to have aspirations. We have to have goals. And, yeah, so even though that's a trick question. It is a trick question, Chris. That's a really difficult one. So I think I've
saved the best till last.
I'm living in the present moment. Like I said, looking back, and I have lots and lots of fond memories. And I just want to say as well, I think I've been extremely lucky as well. You know, and I've had a good life, and I've travelled. I've met fantastic people. I'm also very, very excited about the future, what the future holds, and hopefully 2024 will be a good year. And
I've heard a lot of people actually say that 2024 feels like it's going to be a turning point on so many levels. Interesting that that there feels like there's a lot of change in the air. So this will go out in 2024, and anybody listening will say yes. The prophets of what we're recording is the 28th of December 2023. So hopefully that positive spin will be borne out.
I've got to say, 2023 has probably been one of the most challenging years of my life to date. You know, I'm going to be completely honest. So I am looking forward to having a fresh start, clean slate, 2024. I'm gonna write a journal every day, and little things, little resolutions. I will stick to. But no, I'm really excited about the future.
Well, it has been amazing to have met up in person and to have done
finally,
Sally. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you for the invitation.